This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Would you please put your hands together and give a very warm welcome to the wonderful author, Mr. Tom Cheshire.
Thank you, Zoe.
After you, Zoe.
Now, thank you very much for coming. Now, I've just written a book about the Maldives, which most people think, when they think of the Maldives, they think of Condé Nast Traveller, nice covers, glossy magazines, paradise, water villas, very expensive holidays, honeymoon heaven. And indeed, that is the way it's normally portrayed when it's written in the press or in magazines and weekend supplements. But when I was going about my job as a travel writer for The Times, where I've worked since 97, so I've been on the paper for 18 years, I became interested in the stories behind the scenes in the Maldives. And it first came to my attention that it was in the early, I think it was about 2005, that much of the money from the resorts was being creamed off to organizations that connected to the regime that was running the country. And it seemed that the money was not going to the right places, going to taxes to help build infrastructure. And the people who deserved to be paid in the country were not getting the wages they deserved. And it was a sticky situation there. And this kind of background, I was aware of the trouble out there. And then it came to my attention that the rules had changed on visiting the Maldives. Now, this was in 2009. A new leader of the country, named Mohamed Nasheed, decided to allow tourists to go to the smaller islands that are not called the tourist islands. They're called inhabited islands, where the local people lived. And from the days of the 1980s, when the hippie trail was strong, the government of the Maldives had not wanted Westerners coming to the country and spoiling the Islamic way of life on the little islands that we were off the beaten track, the non-tourist islands. And so it came to my attention that this new ruler had changed the rules, and you could in fact go to these little islands and stay in guest houses. It was his intention that the money from tourism would go straight to the pockets of real Maldivians, not to these cronies of the regime who owned the big hotels. So it struck me as being a kind of a chance to see a country in a different way. And to be honest, it's not very often in the 21st century that effectively a country opens its doors for the first time. And yes, of course you could have gone to these big tourist islands and spent many thousands of pounds on lovely holidays, and people do that. And in fact, it was estimated on one occasion that the Beckhams, when they went on holiday in the Maldives, they managed to spend £6 a minute on their trip, which is quite a lot when you consider the average GDP per capita in the country is much equivalent of something like, you know, five nights in a hotel. But the chance opened up to come and see these islands, and I booked a ticket. And I began to learn a lot about the country, and find out about the politics. And the man who introduced the rule, Mohamed Nasheed, who allowed people to travel off the beaten track in the Maldives, well, in fact, just before I was going to visit, he was ousted in a political coup, and basically at gunpoint told, if you don't step down, your family's in trouble. And so he stepped aside. And so here we had this country that is regularly in the front of the supplements. It's the beautiful white sand beaches and the palm trees. And you had this political trouble that had surfaced as well. So off I went to kind of visit this new country, and that people had not seen for many years. And there are 1,200 islands in the Maldives, and it stretches about 600 miles from the top to the bottom. And I jumped on cargo ships and ferries and very cheaply travelled and stayed at guest houses for £20 a night. Some of the new guest houses often stayed on the floor of spare rooms and so forth, and travelled on cargo ships overnight and slept on the deck of the floor of the cargo ship. And it was so far removed from the Maldives that is regularly covered. And I began to kind of learn about the stories behind the beauty of the brochure, the perfect image. And so not only was there the political corruption, and effectively a dictator who'd been in charge of the country for 30 years, somehow managing to get rid of the democratic leader and dodgy politics going on, but there was also the issue of human trafficking. Now, you see all these beautiful hotels and big resorts, but in fact, a large number of the population in the Maldives were coming in from Bangladesh or other countries and being promised a wage of a certain amount. Well, of course, when they give their passport to the foreman, they're not giving it back, and then the wages don't come in, and they end up working for several years and not getting paid the amount they should do. And this is in a place where the Beckhams are spending £6 a minute on their holiday. And so that was one aspect. And there was also the rise of extremism. And so the Islamic, it's an Islamic country, and the politics of the political leaders were beginning to encourage the political the extremists in order to have their support in elections. And there were things going on, such as the Buddhist relics in the National Museum were smashed to pieces by a gang who entered the museum. And there was also kind of the growing, the police were requesting that they could grow long beards, and the women were wearing more head veils. So if you have the human trafficking, the rise of extremism, political corruption, men being ousted in coups, and then put all of that together and add the fact that this is the first country that's likely to sink under the sea. So the Maldives, I mean, people know about it being a very low-level country, but only 80% of the country is 1 meter above the sea level. And if the sea is going to rise by 50 centimeters, which is a conservative amount, if you take the scientists' conservative estimate, by the end of the century, well, many of these islands will be uninhabitable. So political corruption, extremism, human trafficking, the threat of going underwater, all of the kind of world's issues seem to be kind of distilled in this watery nation in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And I had a way of going to see it that nobody had really bothered to do before. Nobody had gone round. And so I set off on these cargo ships. I went on 3 different trips. I had to hold down my job at the office. So I would go 17 days out there, return, work at the office, then go back to exactly where I was before and pick up the journey again. And so it's a series of these 3 connected trips. And I went to islands that had not seen somebody from outside for 20 years or more, and they were absolutely startled that, you know, after who was this person turning up on the ferry, and they opened up to me and told me about their culture, and I learned about the rich history of Islam in the country and the Buddhism before that, that has rather been eradicated altogether because Arabization of the country was quite strong in the mid 70s and 80s, and I really went off the beaten track and crossed the equator on little cargo ships, sleeping next to old sacks of onions on the floor, and arriving south of the equator. And my first destination, which was a place called Addu Atoll, which is very southerly in the southerly point of the Maldives. And so that was my first loop, and I eventually went all the way back up and round. But in Addu Atoll, I was interested to find out that there was almost a breakaway country there, that they feel quite different from the rest of the Maldives. The United Suvadive Islands, they actually broke away for a while in the 1960s. So there was a very weird kind of different atmosphere in this southerly place. And when I was there, I went on a tuna fishing boat, which... Obviously, tuna is a very important, along with tourism, tuna fishing is very important to the economy of the Maldives. And it was a fascinating evening. I went at 11:30 at night. Everyone meets up on the fishing boat. And then they go out at night and they shine lights into the lagoon. And they do this in order to attract the tiny little bait fish. And they eventually, after a night of attracting the little fish, they scoop them all up, put them into a net in the middle of this tuna fishing boat, and off we went in the morning at dawn to go and find tuna. And you'd have very rudimentary. I mean, this is how you get the cans of tuna in your supermarket. But they have 16 guys with huge bamboo rods, and they would throw the little bait fish over the sides of the edge and spray water off the back of the boat. And so it would appear as though the water was jumping with fish because they were fooling the tuna. And we'd go and catch, and we went and caught tuna. These guys were pulling the tuna, flying off the back of these huge rods onto the deck, hitting it with a thud and flying off the side. And they caught 500 kilograms of these tuna in 40 minutes. It was absolutely an extraordinary affair. But slowly, through this kind of occasion, I was beginning to get to know the islanders, and I would go out on fishing trips. I would stay in remote islands where they hadn't seen anybody from outside for 20 years. I would be taken around on the back of police mopeds and go on patrol. They have trouble there with a thing called brown sugar, which is a form of heroin, which you wouldn't... But again, yet another problem in paradise. Bit by bit, I would wait. I spent a lot of time waiting at the docks, which I don't actually describe in the book because you don't want to know about somebody waiting in the docks. But I then returned up northwards, and I stopped off at an island called Vilufushi. Now, Vilufushi was wiped out in the 2004 tsunami, and it was an incredibly interesting place. So the population had been removed for several years, and it only returned, I think, in 2009. And they had reclaimed the land, so the water had wiped out, and I think 20 people from the island had died. And so they'd actually reclaimed this whole island, and it was almost an example of where maybe climate change will eventually take us, where places are wiped off the map. But they had rebuilt it, but even though they'd rebuilt it with great help from the British Red Cross and people like that, they'd already lost 100 feet of coastline because of the force of the sea. And so it was incredibly interesting to see this from the front line, this place on the edge of the Indian Ocean and at threat from the rising waves. From this island, I went north up to the Malé, which is the capital, and I stopped off at a place which I nicknamed Emergency Island. But what they're doing is they're building an island 2 meters above the surface of the sea. In fact, they're building another island, which is 3 meters above, I believe. And this is how... It's a very unusual situation to be in, to be basically living on a place that might disappear. And the estimate is that many of the islands will be uninhabitable by 2050, and that's not very far away. Yet, you don't read about any of these things if you pick up most travel magazines and read an article about the Maldives. All you'll find out about is how beautiful the spa was. The most remote place I went to was called Makanudu, and it was right up in the north of the country on the northwest, and it was a place of banishment. And I don't think many people realize that banishment still happens in the 21st century, but if you broke the law in the Maldives, you would face banishment and literally sent to a remote place that's not mentioned certainly in Rough Guide or Lonely Planet, really off the beaten track. And it was there that I spent several days, and in fact I was stranded there due to the kind of high waves, and it was a very dangerous reef on the outside it's a harbour. And I got to know the people, and they had a kind of a party with barbecued it. Everybody went out one day and caught as many fish as they could. And my goodness, these fish were not the type of fish you find in a fishmonger's. They were just the multicolored stuff, whatever they found. And they all had this huge barbecue. And I've never seen such a... they all waited and waited and waited. And finally, somebody clicked their fingers, and they all began eating these fish. My goodness, the fish just disappeared in seconds. It was a huge party on the edge of a street. And before you knew it, there were bones everywhere. And it was just a joyous occasion to be part of something that was so real and very far removed from the five-star hotels and the infinity pools. And so step by step, I went round the country and I learned about its history and sailors who'd been stranded there in the 17th century and written their journals and described how fearful they were when they were stranded. And I learned about the politics. I talked to the resort workers about how poorly often they're treated by resorts, and how the unions have very little power, because if anyone ever complains about anything, the police are called in, and you don't want to be on the wrong side of the law in the Maldives, because there are many examples of people being tortured in prison. And in fact, I talked to one man who had been tortured very badly to such an extent that he broke down, and when I was talking to him, and was in a terrible state, even though it was 20 years on from when he'd been tortured. I also interviewed the former dictator. He doesn't really give interviews that often. He thought I was going to ask him about environmental issues, but I kind of fooled him, and then we talked about all the politics as well, and he became more and more uneasy as I was talking to him and wasn't enjoying the interview at all. I also talked to Mohamed Nasheed, who's the ousted democratic leader who I believe should be in charge of the country right now. I think there's a very unusual election that was held last year or around then, and it was finessed in order that the half-brother of the dictator I talked to is now in charge of the country. And one way or the other, I got beneath the skin of the Maldives in a way that people probably have no idea. I mean, I certainly didn't have any idea about all of this when I kind of stumbled across it when doing my job at the Times. And I just thought, well, here's you know, if we're going to be writing about travel journalism or being a travel writer, let's not shy away from these kind of stories. And so that's why I pursued it. And I had this method of going around. And anybody, I highly recommend it as an interesting, it's like the new version of kind of Greek island hopping. You can have such an adventure, and you can really see places in a very exciting way. I mean, it's a bit rough around the edges on the cargo ships, but I only had a couple of particularly rough nights like that. The rest of the time I was on ferries going during the day, because they don't really like going overnight in the Maldives because the reefs are so dangerous. And so bit by bit, I began to piece together the trouble with the human trafficking, the dodgy politics, the fears of sinking beneath the waves. And I met journalists, I talked to resort workers, I talked to the politicians, I talked to the activists. And I was trying to kind of offer something in travel journalism that I fear. I think the travel sections are very good. They offer consumer travel journalism that is a vital, you save up lots of money to go on your holidays, and you should get good advice from your newspaper. But I was trying to write about the kind of things that don't get covered in the paper. And that was what motivated me and made me enjoy the trip. And I'll try and keep this short, but I'll just kind of end by talking about the postcards that are on your seats. Now, just after I left, a journalist named Ahmed Rilwan Abdullah went missing in the Maldives. And I had talked to two of his colleagues from a group called Minivan News. And Minivan sounds a bit odd, but it means independent in Divehi, which is the local language. Anyway, I talked to them. When I talked to them, we met up, and they fired off their kind of attacks on the way the country was run. And I had a very interesting time talking to them. And in fact, at the end of our conversation, we were followed by the secret police onto a ferry, and they tried to take pictures of me for their files and things like that. So it was a little bit clandestine at times. But anyway, their colleague, Ahmed Rilwan Abdullah, who was writing many pieces about the extremists who are on the rise in the Maldives, and actually reporting on many of these characters who are actually going off to Syria to fight for ISIS. So that's the level of the extremism. And he had been reporting on this and getting up the noses of these groups of people. And one day he was followed back to his home on Hulhumale, which is an island next to the capital, Male. And he was seen caught on the CCTV of the ferry, went back to his house. Somebody heard a scream, and he's not been seen since. And this was the kind of example of what we don't know, what most people don't know about the Maldives. And tragically, it seems unlikely that he's going to resurface, but one hopes. That the group Minivan News, the news agency, sent me these postcards to send out today to try and get that message across, that the government of the Maldives needs to make more of an effort. They've hardly made any effort whatsoever to find this man, and it's almost a complicity that they don't want to upset their supporters, who are these extremists, by digging into it too much and arresting anyone because that might upset their electoral support at the next election. So again, you just never would believe it when you look at the brochure for the Maldives, and I'm sure there are many holidays being sold out here somewhere or other from different tour operators on the Maldives. But it was enjoyable to go and visit and learn about a very rich culture, because the culture does go back many centuries, and they've been more or less independent for all that time. And to touch on these issues and not shy away from them, which I think travel journalism has become a little bit soft. And it was my intention with this book to kind of dig as much as I could in one place, travel and enjoy one of the most beautiful places on the planet. And I tell you, it's stunningly beautiful. And when you come in on a plane and you see these white kind of frisbee-like islands with the white sand, it is truly beautiful. So I would recommend anyone to go there, but to find out a bit about the country before going. And I hope my book will, you know, let people know a little bit more than they did before. So that's my talk, and thank you very much for coming.
Absolutely brilliant. That's fantastic. Thank you so much. And sharing your slides, it really helps to see it, doesn't it? To see where you've been. Does anyone have any questions at all? Anyone? Has anyone? Oh, the gentleman's got a question there. Let me come to you. We want to hear you on the microphone. Hold it nice and
close. Hi there. Yeah, hi. Very interesting talk. Just two questions.
Sure.
One was, can you see it's going to change, you know, so from what the holidays that are being sold today, can you see in the years to come, you know, if someone like you went there to these islands, they wouldn't sort of be so surprised to see the locals. Should you just go for the first one? Yeah.
Okay. Well, definitely. Now these guest houses have opened on these small islands. They're unlikely to go away unless there's a policy change at the top. And there's some worry that the current government might look at these guest houses and be unhappy about them and say, right, let's have an island where there are lots of guest houses in order that they're all in one place and that they can control, as a method of control of what's going on the remote islands. That potentially could happen, but definitely the guest houses are very comfortable. One thing to bear in mind is that there's no booze on them. So this is Islamic country, and if you want to have a drink, you have to zip off to a tourist resort, which is not that difficult if you're even in remote places. That there are very nice hotels which will take a day visitor, so you can do that. But I think the tourism is there to stay. What is sad, I think, is that the Maldivian Democratic Party, who introduced so many great changes in the short period they had in charge between 2008 and 2012. It would be nice to see that party in power. And I think there was a lot of funny, they were nicknaming it the by-election, as in B-U-Y. So there was a lot of, the votes were going in a funny way to the wrong people. And I think that if Mohamed Nasheed regained power, there would definitely be a huge rise in this guest house tourism. I mean, seriously, it would be on the scale of Greek island hopping very quickly, and I think also that I think eventually the alcohol will be allowed in the smaller islands if it did go in that direction, but not now. Not yeah.
So go see when it's still new, I suppose, isn't it? Yeah, and also you were talking earlier, because you were here with us earlier, weren't you?
Yes.
About the fact that when you go to the Maldives to these big resorts, your money is going off to the big boys, in a way.
Yes.
And if you go to these little islands now, which are open to you now, your money is going to the people.
Well, that was why they got the policy in the first place.
Yes,
it was
which is
so
good.
Money, the cash went into people's the right pockets. Not a lot of the hotels are owned by friends of the regime, and the money disappears off to bank accounts in Singapore, and proper taxes are potentially not paid.
This is a great way of looking to go to the Maldives in a different light, isn't it? A different way. Anyway, enough about me talking. Question.
Did you notice any improvement on the environmental stuff, the garbage that gets created by all these resorts that I heard is a big problem? So are the smaller islands doing it differently?
I think there was, well, there definitely, I went to one island, which was the first tourist resort in the Maldives. It's called Corumba. And they had a brilliant recycling, you know, as good as you could possibly have in any hotel. They recycled absolutely everything and did a really good job. And that was a shining example of doing it right. But there is a bit of a, there have been articles and pieces about the Maldives, and the classic journalist thing to do is to go to what they call Rubbish Island, which is called Thilafushi. I went to it because I thought I must do it because every journalist does this. And it was like hell on earth. It was a kind of plastic bottles, like for as far as the eye could see, burning plastic, horrible acrid brown smoke, and these poor Bangladeshi workers tending to all the mess. I just think all the waste gets shoved onto these boats and taken to this island and burnt. I think probably if you go to a rubbish dump anywhere, it's not very nice. Doesn't matter which country you're in. So anyway, it wasn't a very nice place.
Any more questions? Ladies and gentlemen, at the back, I'm coming to you.
Hi, I think it sounds really amazing what you're doing. And my question is, what advice would you give to someone looking to get a job like yours who's starting out?
Well, it's not the travel journalism is a difficult field at the moment because the travel sections have reduced in size due to advertising. And I wouldn't recommend it as a career path. It's very tricky to getting commissions. If I wasn't on the staff at the Times, I would just have to give up. I mean, there's not enough money in freelance travel writing generally, I'd say. My advice would be to go somewhere and have an angle in mind. So quite often we'll get on the travel desk of the Times, or just someone will call and say, do you fancy something about Vancouver? Well, no. I mean, they've got to kind of develop the idea. So if you're ever going to pitch an idea to an editor, always have, you know, maybe you'd be covering an aspect of Vancouver, such as connection with a musician or something like that. So you kind of you develop your angle and just don't go say, I've been offered to a trip to Switzerland to go skiing. Do you want a story? It's just taking it two steps beyond that. That would be my advice if you do, and I wouldn't rely on travel journalism for income. And that's my other advice.
Just keep writing, I think. Just write. Keep writing.
Keep going.
Keep trying.
If you're passionate about it. And do blogs and things these days. I mean, that's the kind of way it goes.
Just going to squeeze on through. The lady here has got a question.
I was thinking about the missing journalist. Have you filed a petition on change.org or done a social media?
I've written about it on my website. So we had quite a big... That had a lot of... Part of the publicity for my book, I followed a lot of Maldivians on Twitter, and they followed me back. And so I've been able to get messages out in the media through that way. And certainly, I think his plight is getting better known. And I think the government there really does need to properly investigate what happened to him.
We have a question over there for you.
Hiya. 16 years ago, we went on honeymoon, actually, out to the Lakshadweeps, which is the Indian extension of the Maldives, or the Lakshadweep Islands. We were last out in India 2 years ago, and they seem to have disappeared. Like, nobody goes there anymore. We just wondered what had happened, you know?
I don't know much about the Lakshadweep Islands, no. But, no, you would have thought that one of the tour operators here would offer it as a trip. I presume they're quite low level as well, and very... danger, yeah. I don't know. There's a kind of a contradiction in flying to these places and pumping out carbon emissions into the sky. But then again, as I was saying earlier in the earlier debate, I think that tourism helps the world go round these days. And if you took away tourism, I think the world economy would more or less collapse. So it's very simplistic to say don't fly anywhere. I think, as Mohammed Nasheed has said, that the country is in danger of being wiped out. And to me, it's almost become like a symbol of what's wrong with global warming, rather like the polar bear has become a symbol. And I couldn't really believe, you know, as I was digging around, that so much was going on in what everyone refers to as honeymoon heaven paradise. And so the title, Gate Crashing Paradise, seemed right. No, I don't know much about the Lakadive Islands, sorry.
We have another question at the back there.
Good afternoon. We were there before the tsunami and after the tsunami. We went back to the same island, about 40 minutes seaplane from Mali, south of Mali.
Yeah.
Because I believe the seaplanes used to drop in there, during the 1930s to get to Australia. And we were there, and you could see the difference. And what we wanted to do was not give money here to the tsunami fund, but go back to the islands and give money to the locals. That's what we wanted to do. And the little donies, you have a donie from island to island, and the atolls, it's a beautiful place. A beautiful place. But you have to close your eyes sometimes to what's happening. And we went to one of the inhabited islands. That's one of the 200 of the 1,200.
Yes.
And we were there, and we went to the school there. And they love their football, the Manchester Uniteds and the Liverpools. But they showed us where the level of the water came up to, and it was really scary.
Yeah.
You know. So the question I ask is... Well, as about all the rubbish and everything else, it's being recycled. But the thing is that it's very low-lying. It's the highest point is about 8 foot, and they're building islands, as you say, reclaiming the islands. So how many of those 200 inhabited islands will be surviving, as you say, by 2050? How many will survive?
Well,
it is scary for them. And they're a lovely, lovely people. They are nice people.
Yes, they are, yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. The scientists I talked to, there was an observatory on an island called Hanimadu, and he thinks that half the islands will be uninhabitable by 2050. I think that's what he said to me. When I went to Vilu Fushi, which is the one that was wiped out, and to another island called Izdu, I talked to people and they had stories about clinging onto the tops of palm trees and being holding on for dear life. I mean, they're really gripping stories from the tsunami. And one story about a child who was deposited to two islands away and found in a coconut grove. I couldn't quite believe was, you know, if you've been through such a traumatic experience, to be so level-headed about it so soon afterwards. And I was amazed that the level-headedness and kind of lack of great psychological impact. There are still some people afraid to swim and things like that. But they've really kind of just got on with life as they needed to.
We have another question down here.
Hello, Tom. Hello. What sort of vegetation do you find on the island? I know, gather from a lot of the pictures, that it's mainly... You see a lot of coconut palms and so on. Is it entirely that, or do you get other kinds of vegetation as well?
Well, it's mainly coconut trees. They have a thing called magu, which is like a kind of green leaves about that big, and kind of a like thick, kind of jungle-like plant. And they also grow many of their own. You know, they have watermelon. They have islands where they have allotments and farm. So you have like watermelon farms and chilies and cucumbers and all sorts. So they're kind of very, very fertile inland on some of the islands. But generally it's palm trees and beach. It's what you see on the front cover of the book. It's not much different to that.
Beautiful. Any more questions? The gentleman at the back. Your microphone is coming to you.
What kind of visas do you need, and approximately how much are they? And is the food imported from other parts of the world, or how do they...
Okay. I'm not sure about a visa. I don't think there was one. You caught me out there.
The lady over there might know about visas. She put her hand up.
Just after the tsunami, it may have changed, but you got the visa at the airport.
Yeah, I don't think there was a visa requirement, but I'll have to look into that one. I've forgotten.
They stamp your passport.
Yeah. The first thing that happened to me was I bought a bottle of Bombay Sapphire Gin at Colombo Airport, and it got confiscated immediately when I arrived
because
I hadn't realised about the rules.
Oops. Yeah. What was your other question? It was about visas and the food. Is it imported?
Oh, the food. So the food, they basically eat a hell of a lot of tuna. And it's very good, very healthy food, rice. There's a dish called Garudia, which is, if you look up Maldivian food and look up that, and it's delicious, and I've never seen it anywhere. Apparently, there's one Maldivian restaurant in the whole of Britain, and it's on the edge of Salisbury. So if you want to try Garudia, go to the edge of Salisbury. But I think things were imported from, like, Sri Lanka. So you kind of, like, powdered milk and stuff like that. But generally, they're pretty self-sufficient with the fishing and...
They have lots of fruit, a lot.
And I'm trying to think what else. A few chicken dishes, but generally, they eat a lot of tuna.
Tuna. Right. Do you like tuna? You'll be sorted. Yeah. Wonderful. Any more questions? Lots of vegetarian food, I'm sure. Yeah, lots of rice, you said, vegetables, fruit. Yeah?
Yeah.
And spices. Is their food quite spicy?
Quite spicy, and also kind of flatbreads. So they do like a very simple, not like naan. Thinner than naan.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Any more questions? Oh, lady at the back, sorry. See you.
You were saying that you spoke to a lot of leaders there. Do you ever feel that any of the questions you were asking were sort of unsafe or dangerous at any point?
Well, not... when I talked to the former dictator, I asked him a lot of questions about green policies and the environment, which were kind of non-political as a beginning. And then I asked him about people who'd been tortured in prison and how the elections had been, what had happened, was it a coup, who had organised it. And so I did feel a little bit, he wasn't particularly happy with me by the end of it, and he was glad to see me go. I went beneath the radar, I think. It was only when I saw the minivan news journalists, when I interviewed them and talked to them, that I got a sense that I might have been followed a bit, but I think if I went now, they'd certainly be on to me.
They recognise your face now.
But I didn't feel in danger. No.
That's good. Do you think would you like to go back?
Not for a while.
Not for a while.
But okay. It's so beautiful that I wouldn't want to not go back.
No, wonderful. Yeah. Have you got a next plan and another book pipeline?
I've got an idea about writing about trains, but I'm not sure exactly what.
What did I say, ladies and gentlemen? Didn't I say that? Yes, thank you. For those of you who were earlier, wasn't I saying there was a theme of this whole show, which we didn't know was going to be a theme, is train travel, basically a great way of exploring a new country.
Yeah.
And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. He's just said about trains.
Okay.
I love it. I love it when we connect the dots through the days. No, everyone's been raving about train travel.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's the right book to be writing.
So there you are. Exactly. So where are we going to be travelling on by train?
Great train journeys of the world. I mean, the Times has actually written a book, has produced a book, colourful book, but more kind of...
Is that with Julian?
Yes.
Julian Hond, who was here on Thursday.
Yeah. And so maybe along that line, but it's so... haven't really formulated the idea properly.
But that's your next...
Idea.
And have you booked your holiday for this year?
Yes. Yeah.
Where are you off to?
I'm going to Dorset.
Dorset. Good boy. Keep it in.
Yeah.
Good old Britain. Fantastic.
Well, thank you.
Does anyone have any more questions? I think that wraps it up so beautifully. Wonderful. Tom Chesh, everyone.
Thanks,
massive
sir.
Big thank you.
We'll be blogging and posting recordings of all the events live each day, so check back for more.